Hello and welcome to this month's For Your Consideration for the month of June. And as ever, it's me, Luke, and my co-host, Michael. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Hello. Yes. Happy June in me.
Yes.
Hooray.
And we are recording this after a full start because of the heat wave. Things went slightly awry last night and they're slightly cooler today. And by the time you're listening to this, in a few days' time, hopefully it will be a bit cooler.
Yes.
And since you can't see this, but since last time's Fifth Element, I have bought the Blue Bricks police hover car, which is by no means an official Fifth Element thing, but
it's very nice. It's very blue.
It is
a nice thing. It is a thing of beauty.
There are some stickers for it, which I haven't stuck on it. They do.
Well,
do
I must admit
the taxi as well, but that's out of stock. So I'm tempted to buy the taxi when it comes back.
So is it like not Timu Lego, but is it fake Lego, or is it using original parts? Or
it's not Lego, but it's a German company called Blue.
Is it Lego-esque?
It's Lego-esque. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. I've been inspired, but because listeners won't know any of this, but you were sending me photographs of a rebuilt. Well, no, you started off by sending me photographs of your Back to the Future car.
Yes.
Which was very nice. So nice that I may have bought the considerably cheaper, smaller version of the Back to the Future car for Father's Day.
Yes.
Yeah, because apparently in Sainsbury's it's like $18.50. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
And you know me and tiny people, and I can put it on the time travel shelf. But I was inspired by that. But what you did was you'd looked up new instructions that could take the original kit and turn them into something else. So you ended up with a Terminator head, which is pretty damn cool.
Yes. If for anybody that doesn't know about Rebrickable, it's basically a website where people can you can log your Lego collections, and then people design what are called MOCs, which I think stands for My Own Creation. And you can do one where you go, well, I've just used parts from this set. And there was a guy who's basically built loads of things out of Millennium Falcon sets. And also the DeLorean set. And one of the things he built out of the DeLorean was it's using less than half the parts. He's built a Terminator head. So I was like, I'm going to do that. So currently my DeLorean is half in bits and the other half in Terminator head form. I should post something on X or wherever else you find me on social media for people who can't see any of these things. Anyway, that was an aside. Michael, it's your turn this month. And listeners who were with us last month will know. And if you're listening to this, you'll see it in the title. We are talking about Highlander.
Oh, yes, we are.
1986 movie.
Yes. Not the new one. Not the one that's out next year, / this year, / eventually, with Henry Cavill playing Connor McLeod. Not that. No. Not the TV series. Not any of the 17 sequels. Not the animated cartoon series. But the one and only Highlander that people think is the only thing that existed.
Yeah, I did do a little bit of reading and discovered quite how poorly the sequel was made and received.
Yeah. Well, apparently, and obviously this is meant to be the bit of conversation at the end, but that's fine. This is the legend, okay, that the film was considerably better. Well, we'll be leaving that one. And what happened was a tin of nail varnish remover or acetone or something got spilt on a can of negatives, and they had to reshoot quite a lot of the middle. Again, and I don't know how much of the middle you would have to replace to make that film good. You'd have to replace quite a lot of the beginning and the end, as well as the middle, to make it good.
But we're not talking about any of that.
We're not. None of that. No.
You said that you were quite worried bringing this film because of how much you love it. So tell me your history with the film. When did you first encounter it?
Right. Without wanting to sound like the old grandmother of the Golden Girls. Picture it. Wall's End. 1987. Possibly. No, hang on. Right. Let's get the dates right. I'm doing my GCSEs. Now, that would... I'm 72, so it's sort of 1987-ish. Okay, so that's the year that it comes out on VHS.
Right.
And because of the way the British school system works, you have to do PE lessons all the way through your schooling. Okay, so obviously I am one of nature's athletes, and I congregate to my tribe. That's what we do. So I'm talking to Chris Wilson, who is part of my tribe. And he says, oh my God, I've just seen this film, right? Now, him, Daniel Brook, and a few others, they'd come from one feeder middle school and we were in another one. So we'd kind of all melded together and we'd all refound ourselves by this point. So during this PE lesson, while I'm wearing tracksuit bottoms because I'm not going to get cold in Wall's End, there's very little actual moving around. The people who want to play football are somewhere else on the massive field. So standing relatively close to the goal, but not close enough to be of any threat or defence purposes, we're stood still, and he tells me the entire plot of Highlander in this one-hour double PE lesson. I leave that PE lesson going, oh my God, I need to see this film. He described the basic plot of Immortals. He described the fantastic sword fighting. He described so much Queen, ridiculous amount of Queen. And let's face it, heavy metal, rock, all of that business was big when I was at school. So I was quite enthused by this. So trip down the VHS, the video library. And, I say video library, you know, it's the corner shop that happened to have shelves of discreet weird stuff on the top and very odd things and some nice cult stuff and a basket full of bogged. You're picturing, it's the VHS shop that people don't show you photographs of because they're all like, oh, yeah, we've got these massive chains. Oh, no, this was owned by the bloke who owned the corner shop.
Right.
And I got Highlander out, took it home and watched it. And I think I watched it twice. That like we just rewound it and just started again.
And this was a full frame or widescreen VHS?
Sorry, this is 1987. This is full 3x4. Right, it doesn't get to be a widescreen VHS until one of the classic re-releases years later, where it's some sort of art house release where you get extra top and bottom. This is before that you could even get widescreen TVs. You were just getting full screen, full frame, or whatever it was called. So, yeah, this was one of the films that when we ended up getting... this was when we must have the VHS player by this point because we started with Betamax. And the first thing I ever recorded was Time Lash. So that will place you perfectly with the timings of that. We had the Betamax for years, and obviously you couldn't hire Betamax recorders. So we got a VHS player that wasn't great, but obviously being me and me and my dad, we're going to figure out how to copy from VHS that we'd hired at the shop via the gift of cables into the Betamax. So I ended up having Highlander on Betamax that was just a copy straight off. Press play and record, walk away. We managed to figure out how you could do it using the tuning settings. And then we also discovered how you could do it using direct phono leads with a BNC connector. You see, there'll be people out there who are going, what the hell? You just plug in an HDMI lead in one end and in the other end. No. The world of cables was off.
Well, the cables,
right?
Yeah.
So we did that and we could have me and my dad really quite liked Highlander. So we made our own Betamax copy, which I'm pretty sure survived until about 2 years ago, like in a cupboard somewhere, because we just never got around to taping over it because it was just a film. And because it was the sort of film you could hire, wasn't going to be very expensive, and it was the sort of film you could copy and own your own. And eventually when people were doing sell-through videos for a tenner, which is quite a lot of money these days if you worked out the maths, you could own Highlander. And that's what made this film, which was admittedly a bit of a flop at the cinema, an absolute must-have classic that we all owned, all of us. Because one person makes a copy, they make a duplicate. Because if you can go from VHS to Betamax, you can go the other way. You can do Betamax to VHS and give your friends copies. Make friends. They'll give you a blank tape and they'll go home and they will worship that copy. So everyone had, it wasn't just me. There was lots of people going, have you got Highland? Have you got this? That was the sort of thing. I mean, obviously the big one everyone wanted at the time was Clockwork Orange, which you could only get by going to Holland and buying a VHS there and bringing it back because it was banned in this country.
Right,
it was
yes.
That kind of thing. But that was when I hit university. That was when I already had the big back catalogue of very rare stuff. But at this point, when I'm 14, 15, Highlander was the film we all watched. We all quoted ridiculously to each other, and we still do to this day. You know, I mean, obviously there's the "we can be only one," but when somebody goes to this day, nobody knows his name, and you just find yourself in your head going, "I know his name," and there's lots of there's lots of little stuff. It just fits into your psyche really well. There's loads of really, like, when I'm if ever I'm in a boat, I've got Sean Connery saying "balance," BALANCE. If there's a rowboat or anything like that, it's weird. You get that. So it was yes, it's camp. Yes, it's got its flaws. But at the time, there was only the one Highlander film. It had a beginning, a middle, and end. It had an ending that made sense story-wise. It was just brilliant, and it was our film. It was something that belonged to us. Have you ever seen The Goldbergs?
No.
Okay, there's an episode of The Goldbergs with Clancy Brown playing the woodwork teacher.
Right.
Where the guy creates Highlander Club, and there's another Highlander Club at school, and there can be only one Highlander Club, so they have to take on each other to be who's the real Highlander Club. And they're all wearing long coats, which admittedly I bought. I used to wear a long coat. It's fine. You're not going to hold that against me. And we loved, there was swords, whatever. What do you need? And it just spoke to us. It really did. And that's why I was nervous to bring it to you, because the 14-year-old me obviously lives inside all of our heads. All of the kids' version of ourselves lives there still. You can't repress them. You shouldn't. And that person was like, "This is a great film." And the adult me was going, "Is it though? Are you sure?" And the kid me is going, "Oh, yeah, it's Highlander." And the rest of me is going, "Yeah, but do you remember the bit where you can see the strings at the end? And you could see them on VHS, never mind see them on HD, bloody Blu-ray copy." It's like,
I clearly didn't notice any strings.
My God. On VHS, they were practically Gerry Anderson Thunderbirds painted the wrong colour to match the background set. He rises into the air when he's got the quickening at the end. On VHS, they were the most obvious strings you've ever seen.
Okay, to say I didn't notice. I wasn't. Yeah. I was clearly wrapped up in the
You
the
must
moment.
Have been. So that was why I was nervous. The 14-year-old me, who has got unquestioning love for this. So that's it. So basically, it's me as a kid going, will Luke enjoy this now? I was torn. That was why I was worried. Yeah.
But also, I suppose, how many times have you how often have you revisited it over the years? And when was the last time you watched it? So were you kind of trepidatious about watching it now with your adult head on?
No, not at all. Because it's like, for me, it's like watching Doctor Who of the time. I'm not going to really judge it. I know it's got flaws, but I also know how glorious it is, because I like seeing those transitions from one scene to another blew me away. And I was like, I want to do that. I want to make films. I want to make films this good. So I was never going to go, it's a bit crap.
Right.
I was worried that there might be accidentally some bits that I hadn't realised would age badly. Like, you know, we've discussed this in the past, like like last time with the air hostesses and things like that getting in the way. I was a little bit concerned there might be something that had just so soaked itself into my psyche that I just didn't even register. But I thought, sod it, let's go with it. So that I was worried, but not as much as I would be about some other stuff.
And having had that thought, is there anything in it that you think has aged badly?
Well, I suggested watching this with my wife and my daughter, and my wife's just wasn't up for it at all. My daughter's just busy because she's doing her A-level mocks. But my wife just went, she said, "Well, there's a rape in it." And I went, "Yeah, but that's like the entire motivation for Connor to drive him on to take on the Kurgan. It's like, it's kind of revenge and a lot of other stuff as well." And that was it for me. That was the only questionable thing, but it is actually an important part of the narrative.
Yeah, and they don't show it.
And they don't show it at all. So I think it's quite well done. That was it. So I was a bit worried, unless you've spotted stuff that the policeman's attitude towards Nash, but he's not a very nice policeman anyway. So when he's like, "You faggot, Nash," and all that business, it's hardly... I'm sure the real police would say considerably worse stuff.
Yes. Yes, so, I mean, I think that was... obviously, the language in that scene was uncomfortable, but it wasn't... Because, as you say, because the cop in question is, you know...
Yeah.
You're not supposed to like him.
No, you're not.
You're supposed to, I guess, I think, sympathise with the guy in charge, who's like, yeah, what's going on? And obviously, you're supposed to like, and I've already forgotten her name, scientist, forensic lady.
Yeah, forensic lady, yeah.
Like, they're the people in the police that you're like, okay, yeah, we're supposed to like these people. But like, everybody else is a bit kind of scummy. And so I think it's one of those things where you're like, yes, particularly, I'm sure particularly if you are gay, then hearing those words is uncomfortable. But actually, as you say, you know,
But then there was
it's context. Yeah. Context kind of says, well, you know, this is how it probably was. So yeah, no, I mean, I think it clearly feels like a piece from the 80s. You know,
In
terms
I did
of the
enjoy...
style and in terms of like the music and everything. You know, I think it probably has aged reasonably well.
So the thing that I got from you was I got this text message that said you were confused. You said you'd watched the first half hour and you were confused and you were enjoying it, but you were confused, which I think's fine because there's that whole Hitchcock thing where an audience would rather be confused than bored.
Yeah, well, I think it's just that the non-linear nature of the storytelling means that it takes a while for you to figure out exactly what's going on.
You just have to go with it, don't you?
Like, it becomes obvious that he's lived for 400 or 500 years. Like, that becomes obvious relatively early on. But like, what's with the sword fight in the car park, with the chopping the guy's head off, like
with the guy who looks like Edward Woodward?
Why is that? And what's the whole wrestling? Why is he watching wrestling and then goes into the car park to fight the guy? And then why does all hell break loose once he's killed him? You know, like, what is that? And then, you know, the flashing back to, like, him essentially becoming immortal, but, you know, like, why? And obviously it's only when Sean Connery turns up and starts to explain that you're like, oh, okay, right, this is what's going on. I enjoyed the structure of it, you know, the constant sort of flashing back and forth between the past and the present to kind of sort of give context and explain why he is the way he is.
The VHS release had actually said a time travel drama, and I never thought of it as a time travel thing at all.
Which it isn't, really.
Which it isn't.
No.
It's got it takes place over an extended period of time.
Yes.
But that's it goes backwards and forwards. But each era has got its own way of being filmed as well.
Yes.
Scotland really
looked gorgeous.
Yeah, Scotland's an extra character in this. Absolutely.
We had the Scottish stuff in Chariots of Fire, which, to be fair, wasn't particularly visually exciting for Scotland.
No.
I mean, I suppose it was mostly Edinburgh. But this was like, you know, we're in the Glen, it's vibrant. I mean, it's one of those things where you're watching it going, could we have some of this cinematography again, please?
Yeah. You know? The guy who directed it is MTV royalty.
Right.
Okay. He's the bloke who directed Vienna.
Right.
You name some of the best pop videos and his name's on it.
Right.
You just look him up on Wikipedia, you'll be like, yeah, he did. Oh, he did that as well.
Right.
So he's definitely got, but apparently he was very economical with the way he shot. He knew he'd done so much prep beforehand. He knew exactly which shots he wanted.
Right.
And just got those.
Right.
He didn't get anything before it or after it. There was no like safety stuff. It was just, that's what he went for and that's what he got.
So quite Hitchcocky in that regard.
I'm pretty sure, yeah. But it looks magnificent. It stands up really well. And Scotland looked, it was just an advert for Visit Scotland.
I mean, less so the accents.
You see, we've got problems. Maybe that is one of the things that was a potential warning thing. But we used to take the mick out of it even at the time.
Right.
It's like, right, so Sean Connery, the only actual Scot in the film, plays an Egyptian who's been to Japan, who's lived in Spain. He's, 3,000 years old?
Yeah.
And he sounds more Scottish than anybody else in the film, including the other Scots.
Yeah, so on that note, sorry, this is slightly tangential. I didn't fully understand the bit about the sword, right?
Right.
Like, because I got the fact that, like, you know, the sword is old because it's his, but I didn't get why that meant that the innovative technique that it used could have been invented earlier in time.
Right. Okay, so now this is where Michael, the man who used to work at the Royal Armouries, kicks in. Okay. For a start, that's where the film came from, the Royal Armouries. The filmmaker was, the original writer visited the Royal Armouries when it was based in the Tower of London.
Right.
And saw the collection, which is now in Leeds. And he went, wouldn't it be great if it was a story where one guy owned all of these things, the entire history of swords
sword
and
making.
Armor.
Right, yeah.
Okay. And it was like, so how could that happen? And then he went away, he was still a student at the time, and wrote a couple of drafts and showed it to his professor and went, yeah, you need to sell this script. Now, the original script's got a lot of differences in it. It's a lot more like sort of, Captain Harkness from Torchwood.
Right.
You know, he's a lonely character, but he's been married lots of times.
Right.
He's got like 56 kids. There's lots of other stuff going on. It's not that they can't have kids at all.
Right.
It's just... So there's a lot of stuff that the other writers get brought in to expand on it, but the original story's very Royal Armouries. Okay, so I own, because I like swords, I own the Highlander sword, the Claymore.
Right.
Right? And it's next to my bed on my side, screwed to the wall. Burglar comes in. Okay, I've got a sword. Now, I know for a fact you're not supposed to use weapons against burglars because they could take them off you and use them against you. Okay? That's why you don't do it. On my wife's side of the bed, she's got Needle from Game of Thrones. A smaller, more elegant weapon. It looks great. Apparently, I'm not allowed to have the lightsaber up. Well, you know, hey. But anyway, right. No, I've got they've got their own little mounted boards and everything. So I've got the Highlander sword in. That's how much I love this film. I don't have any other film memorabilia in the bedroom. It just looks nice on next to the bed, above my bedside cabinet. You know, there's bedside cabinet and then vertical Highlander sword.
Yeah.
I'm probably not coming across out of this as anything other than a gigantic geek, but that's beside the point.
I mean, unless people are listening to us for the first time, I think they already know this, Michael.
Well, that's true. We've been at this... I mean, what? You've had your YouTube channel 19 years today.
Apparently so, yes. I logged in and was like, oh, yeah. I mean, I've had a YouTube channel since before Google owned it.
That's nice. That's very nice. So where were... I'm sure I was actually telling a story.
So I was asking about the whole thing that she finds the fragments of the sword in the pillar.
Oh, right.
It's
so, okay.
And
so
it's the whole,
the
like,
Japanese
like
swords...
finding a jumbo jet in 1,000 years prior. And I didn't quite understand why that was the case.
In order to make Japanese steel stronger, you fold it over itself. So you flatten it, fold it over itself... while in a furnace, hammer it flat,
right.
Then fold it, then hammer it flat. And every time you fold it and hammer it flat, you're lining up the molecules.
Right.
So it's making the steel stronger. And this sword, this one that was owned by Ramirez, which was made by his wife's, his father-in-law, basically, was folded 1,000 times, which is a ludicrous amount of steel folding to make it a stupidly strong sword.
Right.
So it was done much earlier using technology. It's like the, I mean, it's obviously made up for the film, but it's like the Knight's Tale, where she makes incredibly thin, lightweight armor.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay.
It's that kind of thing. It's like, well, but yeah, let's just say it's really cool.
Right.
And they've all got to have swords.
Yes.
Because they want to take off heads. And that's the chosen weapon of the time.
Yeah. So let's have a can we have a conversation about immortality? Because you're immortal, but you can have your head cut off, means that technically you're not immortal, right?
Yes. Well, no, you can be killed. It's like barring accidents, you're immortal. That's the standard thing. Because vampires are immortal, but they can have stake through the heart.
Right, yes, I suppose it's... Yes, it's no
there is
from
an
that,
argument
really, is it?
Yeah. That this is a vampire film, but without the blood.
Right, and they're not preying on humans, they're just preying on each other.
True, and then they get the quickening, which is weird. Which to be fair is just regeneration done with a 1980s movie budget. It's like, it, you know, there's, it might as well, if it was done now, there's going to be lots of, like, I guarantee you in the new movie it's going to look a lot more like David Tennant regenerating.
I hadn't made that comparison, but yes, new series Doctor Who regenerations are, you regenerate and blow up the TARDIS. So in this you kill somebody and then blow up a bunch of cars in a car park. Yeah.
Which is, as a sideline, that's completely dealt with, the difference between new series of Generation and old series of Generation in the new War Doctor and Ronnie box set from Big
Finish. Isn't it a Time War thing? They were like, we're going to make regeneration as a weapon, essentially.
So, near enough. Yeah. Well, it's because Time gets rewritten so many times. It's just stupid. Anyway, not important.
Yes.
There's so much to talk about, but The narrative setup is you get the prize, and the prize is apparently you know everything, but he doesn't really know what the prize is, but they're fighting for it anyway.
Yes.
And there's moments that make no sense if you think about them. Things like the Kurgan's turned up.
Yeah.
How does he know that McLeod's there? Is it just that they can sense each other's presence? Is that how Ramirez knows he's there? They can sense them. And then he says, remember our agreement, there's one called Connor among them. And it's like, hang on, you've done your research beforehand. Why do you need to... I knew you're telling us, the audience, that the agreement is you'll fight on their side that reason.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I hadn't really thought about that. I guess you can just, like you say, you can hand wave and just go, they can...
You can hand wave a lot of this.
Because obviously, you're like, why does Sean Connery come and find him? Presumably, he must sense that another immortal has been born in the Highlands, and therefore he goes to because he's a...
I do like that some of them are friends. Like the weather meet on that bridge in New York, he goes in his coat as if he's getting his sword out and it's just a bottle.
Yes.
That's a beautiful moment. It's so well done.
But ultimately they kind of dodge the more... and maybe, again, it's the nature of the film. It's supposed to be entertaining primarily, but again, there's a depth there that you're like, well, in like Good Omens, you kind of see the two of them meet over the years, and you do have the odd flashback to Connor's life. So you have the duel, and then you have the bit where he finds Rachel, but he has a relationship with Hugh Cauchy's character, and my understanding is that there were more scenes with them that got cut.
I would not be surprised.
Any of the deleted scenes didn't survive or something because they were lost in a fire. I think it's what I read. You kind of dodge the fact that they're all congregating in New York to kind of have this final showdown, and you could have the conflict of like, oh, am I going to have to kill my friend? But you kind of dodge that by having the Kurgan bump him off, and so then it's just the two of them left. But there was a dilemma there that they could have explored, but they didn't.
I mean, apparently there's the legend of a deleted whole scene and storyline with the guy who played the Chinese detective. Is it David Yip?
Yes.
In Britain. Again, similar sort of thing. I think it was just somebody else for the Kurgan to kill on his way. So that would have been yet another... Yeah. So there are legends. See, that's it. There's a lot of stuff in the background. You don't know what's true, you're not. It's not. You can even read the Wikipedia page and you're like, how much of this is real? How much of this is just they made a movie and it was nice and it was surprisingly successful because people like us watched it on VHS. It wasn't the most successful film at the cinema at all.
That's what I heard. Yeah,
it was a bit of a flop, but it spoke directly to our generation, the generation who'd watched Terminator and wanted to watch something else, because Clancy Brown's just doing a kind of upmarket, better version of the Terminator.
I was going to say that. That was the film that it sort of reminded me of in some aspects.
Yeah.
You have that final kind of showdown. I mean, obviously the difference being...
Again, the legends are Arnold Schwarzenegger was approached to play the Kurgan.
Oh, right. Well, okay. I can see that. I guess the difference with the Terminator is that Sarah Connor is a very... Oh, Connor. There we go. Sarah Connor
absolutely not noticed that.
No, Sarah Connor is at the heart of it, and she is this very strong character. Whereas, and again, I can't remember her name. What is her name? What's the name of the whatever her name is? Anyway, but she ends up, she starts off as this quite independent character, quite a strong character, and then she just ends up as a sort of damsel in distress for the final. The final showdown, which I felt was the weakness of kind of how it ended up.
Roxanne,
there we go. Or is that the name of the actress?
Roxanne Hart is Brenda Wyatt.
Yes, yeah, Brenda.
Brenda.
Brenda. So, though, I have to say, the chicken scene was genuinely disturbing.
Okay.
You know, where he takes her and he goes, "Have you ever played chicken?" And then he drives.
Oh, yeah, where he's sort of laughing.
He's
manically.
Just laughing. Because, and you kind of feel, you know, as he gets his kicks, presumably, over the years, he's got his kicks from doing stupid things. You know, obviously, you see Connor doing the duel where Connor's just laughing at the fact that he keeps getting shot and not dying.
Yeah, because he's just really drunk.
You can imagine the Kurgan has kind of had a life where he has, you know, he's got his kicks out of doing stupidly dangerous things because he knows he can't die. And the juxtaposition of him laughing his head off and her being absolutely terrified, it was quite disturbing to watch that bit. I was not saying it was bad. I'm just saying it was really well done because it reached into me in that kind of visceral kind of way, and I was like, "Oh, this is uncomfortable."
Clancy Brown's one of these people I've never seen put in a bad performance.
I mean, he's chewing the scenery like nobody's
business.
Oh,
no, he is. But he's like, it's like the guy who played Avon. He's
Paul
just,
Darrow, right?
Yeah, he's Paul Darrow level. he's brilliant. And I mean, have you seen Starship Troopers?
I've seen the odd bit of it.
Oh, and he's very good in that.
I mean, my main touchstone, obviously, is Shawshank, right?
Like, oh, yeah, fair enough. Yes. All I was about to say was, and this shows you the level I'm on, he does one of the main voices of one of the main characters in SpongeBob SquarePants.
Does he?
Because he's got a really good voice. Yeah, I think I'll have to look it up.
I hadn't realised that. Okay. I mean, most recently...
I'm not looking it up now.
Most recently, he turns up in High Potential.
Okay, I don't...
It's a...
Oh, yes, yeah.
He's the dad of the cop who she falls in love with. And at the end of the most recent season, he's been stabbed or shot or something. Sorry, spoilers.
That's all right.
And Clancy Brown is obviously his slightly nefarious dad. But I remember watching it going, and I said to Hannah, "Oh, it's the guy from Shawshank." She was like, "Oh, yeah, it is." And then I was watching this going, "Oh, it's the guy from Shawshank."
We do have Shawshank to watch, me and Verity, sort of on the hard drive. We've got it all, we've taped it off TV. We're ready to go.
Ooh.
At some point.
Yeah.
Because she's not... I don't think she's... Has she seen... Oh, no. Oh, is it Shawshank or Green Mile? I think she wanted to see them both. Because, obviously, I've got a very cheery daughter.
Yeah. I mean, Shawshank is... As Mark Como says, there's a lot of Shawshank before the redemption. But it is, you know, the payoff is worth it. It's a very good film. But we're not talking Shawshank.
We're not here to talk about that. Not today. No. Clancy Brown is great in this. I don't know if he got the job. Now, I've bought Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. And I'm pretty sure he's in that with Jeff Goldblum.
Right.
And that's one of those films I actually own on Blu-ray. I've really wanted to see it. It was my mate who died, one of his favourite films, but I've never actually seen it. I've always meant to get around to it. And I'm quite nervous about watching that. In fact, I was actually thinking, should we do a for your consideration of films we've not seen? Stuff we've always meant to get around to at some point.
Oh, interesting.
So, I've always thought about watching it, but apparently he was in that and everyone liked him and they just wanted him in this.
Yeah.
So he must be, you know, a perfectly nice person to be around. Apparently he was very nervous about meeting Connery, and the first scene they did together was when he kills him. And he just burst into the room with a massive sword, screaming, jumped on the table and basically embarrassed himself in front of Sean Connery. And Sean Connery, I think, ran away because he was like, "Jesus, what's this bloke?" Sean's absolutely... Have you there was a making of that's on Sky TV, on the Sky Arts.
Oh, right.
And they discussed some of it. And apparently Sean Connery had originally signed up just going, yeah, I'll just turn up and do a few days. And then he arrived on set and Christopher Lambert had been practicing sword fighting, which we'll need to talk about in a minute, for 4 solid months.
Well, yeah.
So, because he knew that the sword fighting was what would sell this film.
Yeah.
Sell the performance. So he'd just been doing it time and time and time again, just threw himself into it. And Sean Connery was like, "I'm going to just turn up and wave my sword around." And then he saw the standard that was required, was impressed by Christopher Lambert, and they remained friends for his entire rest of his life, which is lovely.
Nice.
Because of that, and Sean Connery went, "Right, I'll kind of have to step up my game here." And then he just practiced sword fighting constantly so that he would be good enough on screen to look like he was the person teaching him. So I think they both sort of found that respect, because he wasn't on set for long, because he's not in the film for long. But it's like him being in Time Bandits. His name's on the poster. He's in it. Thanks very much. And then he goes away.
And he does his thing. Yeah. I mean, I think the thing is, he makes his
mark. He's having fun.
Yeah.
Sean Connery having a laugh. He should have done more comedy. He really should.
He smiles when he dies.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, do you have any other emotions in this film? But I guess it's that thing of like, you're playing a 3,000-year-old guy.
Yeah.
You're probably ready to go, you know, at this point.
Fair enough.
I think it works. I liked him in it. At no point was I convinced that his accent was anything other than Scottish.
No.
Christopher Lambert, bless him, has a go. Worked with a dialect coach, apparently, but isn't great as Scottish. I'm intrigued as to what you think about him as a leading man. It felt to me, particularly at the start, and probably on kind of ongoing through the film, but like, it feels like he's been cast because of his eyes.
Yeah. There's specific lighting on his eyes various points.
But it struck me that his eyes are quite small and deep set. And he just does this kind of brooding stare for a lot of the film.
I think that's why he got the job in Tarzan as well, in Great Earl of Greystoke.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Because he's playing Tarzan, but that's because he's got kind of fairly animalistic human, but slightly not appearance. It's like he's where he needs to be, but he's not of where he needs to be. I think that probably works. I mean, there's Subway before that as well.
But I was struck by that aspect of the filmmaking. You know, that there's close-ups on his eyes. He doesn't say a lot initially.
No.
And that is kind of his character, is kind of this brooding force, which you start to understand as you realise, kind of, you know, he's had this one love 400 years ago, and he's not allowed himself to, you know, get close to anybody apart from Rachel. But that wasn't a romantic relationship, because, you know, they met when she was a kid. And she's, you know, aged beyond him, as it were. But that seemed to be kind of the we're doing the sort of the brooding. And I guess, you know,
the mystery is solved using science as well. They work out using the handwriting recognition thing, where they move the parts of the letters, which...
I was just like, did they have that level of sophistication on computers in 1986?
So they did that with the computer, and also she looks at the times the sword had been folded and hit by lightning as well.
She was
unaware of its electrical charge, because how many times it would have been hit by lightning because of the quickening and stuff like that. That would have thrown the science off. So those two bits of science feed into the thing, and that's how he gets caught out. Because for years, he's just hidden.
Yes. 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 And I suppose he's like the whole, like, he just keeps on inheriting it off himself.
Yeah,
like in The Stones of Blood, where you've got all the various versions of Vivian Fay who've kind of owned the house before, and they've all got their paintings of them all in the cellar. You know, I kind of half expected them to be like, right, and here's a picture of him in whatever point, and here's a painting of him, and all this kind of stuff. But they didn't go, like I say,
no.
They really wanted to focus on,
wouldn't they?
Well, I think
you'd end up with something as shit as the photoshopped picture of the Eccleston doctor at the assassination of Kennedy.
Yes, exactly. No, I mean, to be fair, I quite like the fact that they just focus on the two time periods, really. We're going to tell the Scottish story, we're going to tell the New York story, there's going to be a little bit of stuff in between.
There's going to be a handful of flashbacks,
We're going to focus on this. Beautifully shot, you know, love the cinematography. And you're right, the sword fighting is, you know...
So, guy who does the sword fighting is the bloke who does... the majority of the lightsaber fights, is the bloke who also choreographed the entire Princess Bride sword fighting. It's like, if there was a great sword fight in a film, he did it. Well, and he's ex-Olympian.
I was going to say we've also got to talk about the first guy that he fights in Spot the Doctor Who actor.
Okay. He must be the one I missed.
I think you said there was an extra. Anyway, we'll get to that.
Yeah, okay, we'll do. Well, I've got them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, so, you know, but I think like you say, it's one of those things where you have the connection to it from when you were a teenager, and I don't have that. You know, I enjoyed it, but it's not grabbed me in the way that...
The thing you mentioned last time was the staggering stories people often mention as well. Now, I am closer to their age than I... I'm not as old as some of them, but you know what I mean. It's
I think you're probably similar age to Adam, right? And I think he's talked about it before. So
yeah.
And then there's the whole, like, you know, all the sequels being terrible.
Terrible. But that's a running gag. I mean, I told this story last time. I went to Odeon one, watched because the sequels only exist because of how successful it was on VHS.
Right, okay.
And it was a number of years later. And the sequel makes absolutely no sense. It tries to give out too much backstory.
Like, yes.
How are they immortal? Why are they immortal? What's the point? And then you discover they're all aliens, and they were banished to Earth.
Which doesn't make sense in the context of the first film at all.
Exactly. And Sean Connery comes back to life, and then dies again. And then you're like, oh, for God's sake. And it's just a mess, right? And then there's the third film, but people were so damaged by the second one, they didn't bother seeing the third one, or the fourth one. I think the fourth one's called The Sorcerer or something.
Yeah.
Or The Quicker. Oh, who cares? Anyway, some people liked them. And then there's the spin-off TV series with Duncan MacLeod, where Connor MacLeod's in episode one. And you're like, yeah, but it's a series, and it's just going to be like The Littlest Hobo, but with swords. And yeah, so... A lot of people just didn't bother. I did catch a couple of episodes of the animated series when I couldn't be asked to get off the sofa and turn the TV over, but which was perfectly fine, because often a lot more thought and heart's gone into an animated version than anything else. So I don't know if there's four or five Highlander movies. I couldn't tell you.
I mean, it's got the perfect tagline for just ignoring all of that.
That's what I did. Yeah. I stood up at the end of Odeon one and shouted, "There should have been only one." This was a packed one on opening night, and people cheered.
Because they all thought it was as terrible as you did. Because
they thought, there should have been only one, and there wasn't.
Yeah.
But the writer had a great idea, and that's what he's done. I think he's been involved with all of the other versions.
Right.
So it's kept him employed. It's kept him in money. And you know what? I'm not going to hold that against him. Ever. You had a cracking idea when you were a student at university, and... That one good idea has lasted him his life, and that's good.
How did he get Queen involved?
I have absolutely no idea, but Scotland is an extra character. If Scotland's an extra character, Queen is an extra character.
Yeah.
Because if you've ever watched the It's a Kind of Magic video, or the Princes of the Universe video, it's the Christopher Lambert's in it.
Right.
It's actually in the pop video, because there's one Queen song that is from another album, but then it's the It's My Kind of Magic tour.
Right.
Has loads of these songs in it as well. And Princes of the Universe is one of my favourite songs as well, which is, you know, not a lot of people's primary Queen go-to, but I just love it. And but that's because I love this film, and so. But yeah, I don't know. But Queen's music, and I know the Kurgan puts it on the tape in the car, and then Queen comes out as well, which of course goes back to Good Omens as well. In the book, every tape, no matter what's on the tape, if you play it in Crowley's car, becomes the best of Queen. which is in the book, and it's great. So maybe that's what this is. He's just another character from that. I've not seen the third series / special yet. I am putting it off because I don't want it to end.
I've not seen the second series of Good Omens.
It's not bad.
Yeah.
It's not bad, but I'm... Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think about them remaking Highlander then?
Nervous. However, Henry Cavill is, and I don't want to put too much weight on this one, one of us.
Yes.
Yes,
he's
he is.
He's proper nerd.
Absolute card carrying, fully paid up. I'm going to be in a TV series called The Witcher. I'm going to go away and read all the books before I even turn up on set. Kind of a nerd.
And then I'm going to get cross when they diverge.
Yeah, I'm going to leave this series because they've offered me a part in Warhammer 40K, the role-playing game, the TV series. What? Yes. Yeah.
Well, right. And I'm going to nerd out about Warhammer every time I turn up
every time on a chat show. It's brilliant, right? Right? He is absolutely one of us. The fact that he looks like one of the Hemsworths is going to go in his favour.
Yes.
You know, the guy should be playing James Bond, but let's face it, he'd rather be, like, in Doctor Who.
Yes.
But it's never going to happen. But, yeah.
Have you seen the whole thing of him talking about meeting Russell Crowe when he was at school?
No.
So he met... Russell Crowe came to his school when...
As he's playing Ramirez in the new
version. Yeah, exactly. So they have a connection that goes back to... Yeah. And he basically asked him, like, questions about acting. And then sort of met him years later and was like, do you remember me? And he obviously initially didn't. And then, you know, they sort of bonded over that. And when I saw the cast list for the new one, I was like, oh, there we go. There's the connection between them. Nice. It goes back. And that's why, presumably, he's got him on board. It's one of those things you just go, well, it could be great and it could be terrible.
It could be great, but it could be terrible. But then again, like all remakes, and this is the thing all the geeks forget, they're not taking the original away from us.
No.
They're not coming round our house, breaking in and burning all the copies so that we have to watch the new version.
Yeah.
The all-female version of Ghostbusters does not make the other versions of Ghostbusters better or worse. It's just another version.
True. I think the thing that I find hard is that you have to then clarify what you mean. Because when I mean the Italian Job, I mean the one from 1969.
Yes.
And the existence of the terrible 2000-something version is, you know, let's just forget about that. That's the only drawback of them doing a remake, is that you then have to go, well, no, I mean that one, not this one.
Yeah. What I mean is the good one.
The good one. Have you got any other notes, or should we spot Doctor Who
actors? No, let's just do that. Because we've discussed... Well, hang on, let's have a look. Discuss the Royal Armouries. Discuss the accents. More arrows coming off. Connery is definitely the fun heart of the film.
Yeah.
Lovely montages. All the business with it. Yeah, there's the quickening, regeneration. All there. All there. Let's just move on. And, of course, I mentioned the strings at the end, which you didn't see.
I didn't see. No, I was clearly wrapped up in the moment.
I can't believe you couldn't see the strings. The guy's held up with ropes.
To be fair, if I go back now and I can watch that scene again and I'll be like, oh, right, okay, I know exactly what you're talking about. Should we do the actors that I spotted and then the ones that I didn't spot but I found on the cast list
that you
apparently hadn't seen? So, in order of appearance... the first one I spotted was Peter Diamond, who plays Iman Fasil, who's the first guy that he fights. And he's mostly wearing sunglasses throughout that whole scene. But just before he gets killed, his glasses come off. And I went, is that Peter Diamond? The reason that is because, although he did lots of stunt work, his two main speaking roles are in season 2 of Doctor Who. And I've recently been watching the Hartnell era. So I know exactly what he looks like, because he plays the guy who Ian teams up with in the Romans called Delos. And he plays one of the Morok guards in the Space Museum, again, who Ian forms a bond with. So it's quite... You get these two stories, like two or three stories apart, where Ian kind of hangs out with Peter Diamond. And also, Peter Diamond doubles for Patrick Troughton in the climactic scene where Salamander gets sucked out of the TARDIS in Enemy of the World. So, you know, technically you've got somebody who played... I think he possibly plays both versions of... He plays Salamander and the Doctor in that scene, I think. So you've got somebody technically somebody who played the Doctor in Highlander. And he's also the guy
technically correct, which is the best form of correct.
He almost chops Luke Skywalker in half when he plays a Tusken Raider in Star Wars. You know, he's been in everything. He's got a fantastic name, Peter Diamond. So I was really proud
of him. Well, he's the bloke in my head who I just think of as... The bloke who looks like Edward Woodward.
Right, okay.
So that's fine.
So that was him. Then you told me about National Treasure level. Celia Imrie as Kate.
Yep.
Who you initially think is going to be the love interest, and then she's the one who's like, no, cast him out.
Burn him down.
And because she was in the...
She gets really upset that they're letting him go.
Yeah. She wants him to die.
Yes. He's brilliant.
So she was in the Bells of St. John, right? The Matt Smith one?
Yep, that's the one.
Then we have James Cosmo, who wasn't in Doctor Who, but he was in UFO, in Reflections
of the Water. He was, yes.
But here, looking more like you expect James Cosmo to look, because he's, you know, when I watch UFO, I'm like, is that him? Anyway. And then the other one I spotted was Hugh Quarshie as Castagir, who then turned up in Daleks in Manhattan as Solomon. So I guess, yeah, in New York, both times.
Hang on.
What?
Have you missed one that I got?
Well, no, so I've got three more that I didn't spot, but I've found them in the cast list.
Okay, right. So, Clown?
Yes, I didn't spot him.
Oh, right.
I recognised him, which is why I then went to the cast list to find out what I knew him from. But I didn't recognise him as the Chief Clown.
See, I only got the Chief Clown. I didn't get the cast. Right, got it.
Yeah. Because I was at the end of the film, I was like, okay, so those are the Doctor Who ones I've spotted.
He was in EastEnders for a long time, so I knew what he looked like.
I must have seen him in something else, because I watching it go, I recognise that face. So I've seen him in something else, and obviously in that context, I looked at him and gone, oh, it's the Chief Clown. Yeah, but it wasn't enough. The guy that he shoots in the back is also from Doctor Who. It was Tandril in Trial of a Time Lord. Of Humker and Tandril. You know, the two servants of Drathro, the robot.
Oh, God, right, yeah.
But again,
why isn't there a metal band called Drathro?
Didn't get him. And then the other one was Gordon Stern, who plays the doctor who tells her that the baby died.
Right.
So that one scene. And he was Heldorf in The Ambassadors of Death. But again, I didn't realise it was him until I looked at the cast list and went, I recognise that name. Oh, yeah. Makes sense. So,
according to my research, I've also got Harry Fieldand, who was an extra in 16 episodes of Doctor Who, was the hospital guard.
Okay. I didn't go as far as looking at the uncredited extras.
Right.
Yes.
That was all I could do. You obviously got a lot more.
I feel that Harry Fielder has cropped up in something else, probably Blake Seven. I think he was in Blake Seven when we did Blake Seven.
Very likely.
So so having gone in expecting two or three, like you said, I was like, oh, there's actually some more. I think the one that surprised me most was Hugh Quarshie turning up at that point in the film. I was like, oh, flip, it's Hugh Quarshie. Because I don't know, he wasn't. I knew him as the guy from Holby City before he appeared in Doctor Who, but obviously he was a long time after this that he was in Holby City, so I don't know how much of a career he had at this point.
I watched Casualty at the beginning, but I never really embraced Holby City.
I had a period of watching it when I was a student, I think. It's various things that you watch as a student because you live with people who have very different tastes. At least that's what I found.
Okay, so that was Highlander. Are you glad you watched it?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Yeah, I don't think it was something I would have sought out because it's one of those things people talked about. But
there's
a 4K version due out.
Good. There's a 4K version out this year that comes with a making of book that I will not be buying because I cannot afford it. Yesterday was the day that the Paul McGann Blu-ray /ultra-high-definition disc arrived.
Have you watched it yet?
I've watched the first 2 minutes and gone, bloody hell, that's what Paul McGann's supposed to sound like. Right. Paul McGann played at the proper speed. You're like, okay, that just sounds like I'm listening to a Big Finish now.
Right, okay. Well, I will get to it eventually, but given that my Doctor Who marathon has just reached the end of season three.
Yeah, exactly. You've got a bit of... the predicted date means you'll be able to find it in a bargain bin. There might not even be a society by the time you get round to that point. Right.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So that was Highlander. What have you got for us for next time?
Well, so I'm going to go for the other thing that I gave you a toss up between Fifth Element and something else. So we're going to do the something else. We're going to do Jeeves and Wooster.
Nice. Very nice.
Have you
I owned
seen
them
Jeeves
all
and
on
Wooster?
VHS.
Okay.
Which version?
Well, the Hugh Fry and Laurie. Version,
okay.
Obviously.
No, I thought you might. Well, no, this is us. Yeah. You might have been talking about the 1970s TV.
Oh yeah,
series.
No. I haven't seen any other version.
That's fine.
Of it.
No, can I just say that would not have surprised anybody.
But this is a series that I watched as a kid, owned on VHS, owned on DVD. Would love to own on Blu-ray because it was shot on film, but I can't see them finding a market for a Blu-ray version of Jeeves and Wooster. But anyway,
no.
I will select...
I can see them finding a market for it being upscaled to HD, though, so they could broadcast in HD.
Maybe, maybe. But
look, if they do that with Sherlock
kind of...
Holmes, which the yeah. Jeremy Brett one, why not?
But what it needs is a proper rescan all the film. But yeah. You know, nobody's going to have the budget for that. Anyway, I didn't know whether you'd have seen it or not, or whether it was your cup of tea. So that's why
I owned them all on VHS. It.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I will select a couple of episodes.
Oh, good, good.
To send your way, and then we will chat about the series as a whole. And there are shed loads of Doctor Who actors to spot.
There really are.
And Booster.
they're well, there just will be. That's good.
Cool.
That's nice.
Well.
Right.
I have been very much enjoyed this, Michael, as ever, so I will say farewell to our listeners and leave the final words, as ever, to you.
And as always, be seeing you.